name is Asaf Ramaraus. SPME BDMS conference call. This afternoon, we have the privilege and opportunity to be with my friend and colleague, Benny Weinthal. And Benny is a close friend, a co-author of mine. He has been a research fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. He has focused there on issues related to Europe, a lot of issues related to Iran's energy ties to European firms, as well as Hamas and Hezbollah's terror finance operations in Europe at large. He's also been focused a great deal on the growth of the Islamic State in Europe, anti-Semitism at large, and neo-Nazism. He is also a columnist at the Jerusalem Post, so we are privileged to have him from across the pond to address us this afternoon. This afternoon, he will be talking about European anti-Semitism and the forces against BDS in general, what we're seeing in Europe today in contrast to the environment that we're seeing here in the United States. Let me go over a few basic housekeeping issues for everybody so we're aware of how this afternoon will go. Those of you who have been on the calls before know that if you have a question, of course, we welcome as many questions as you may have after Benny is done talking. You will click, if you're logged in through the computer, on the hand icon, and I will be able to unmute you and you can ask your question. You can also, during the call, there's an opportunity to also email through the system, and I'm happy to read your question as well. If there are questions after the call, as always, if there are issues you want to reach out to us, our email, as always, is bdsmonitor@spme.org. Again, bdsmonitor@spme.org. And you can always email us after the call. We will answer them in a timely fashion. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Benny. And Benny, the floor is yours. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Asaf, and thanks for organizing the conference call this afternoon, and thanks to the members of the SPME who are listening in, and I look forward to questions after my roughly 25-minute presentation. Good questions are better than good answers, and I don't have a lot of answers. In fact, very few answers, but I'll delve in. I'm going to just give an abbreviated outline of what I plan to cover. Some current developments in anti-Semitism in Europe. I'm going to focus mainly on the continent and not in the UK, where there have been outbreaks of anti-Semitism and countervailing forces. I'll focus, most of my work has been in Central Europe, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, the German language speaking countries, and to some extent, France and the Scandinavian countries and Italy. And then I want to just cover one, I think, highly neglected form of anti-Semitism, guilt defensiveness anti-Semitism. And lastly, I'd like to delve into Iran and the role of anti-Semitism. And one other point, it's not the, forgive me, the Iran was not the last point. I'll go into BDS and how BDS is being countered in Europe and where there have been some successes in the academy. First, the last 2 weeks have seen a number of setbacks in terms of countering Israel-related anti-Semitism, or as we all, most of us, I would imagine, are dealing with this outburst of anti-Semitism, modern anti-Semitism, or contemporary anti-Semitism. There's a number of different names for it, but it's mainly about turning Israel into a human punching bag. I wrote earlier this week that, based on a source, that Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel campaigned and looks like she succeeded in having Romania's president urge his country to not relocate their amb- embassy to Jerusalem. This probably took place in April. I reported on it. So it's interesting in light of Merkel's October visit to Israel and her well-known speech in 2008 to the Knesset, where she described Germany's relationship to Israel as one of Israel's security interests are non-negotiable. That's what she said for the security of Germany. So in short, Israel's security interests are integral or part of Germany's security interests and part of Germany's reason for being. Also this week, Germany joined the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Iran in voting against Israel at the UN. Sebastian Kurz, the Austrian chancellor, who has tried to reshape his country's Israel policy into a more pro-Israel camp, also joined Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic to sanction Israel at the UN with resolutions. And this is all by way of background to show, in addition to Sebastian Kurz, the Chancellor of Austria, and Merkel both saying their country's security interests are part of Israel's security interests and the converse, that there's a huge disconnect between the foreign policies of both governments in terms of the praxis or how they're behaving on the ground. The new German foreign minister who started this year, his name is Heiko Maas from the Social Democratic Party, announced when he became Social Democratic, or the new foreign minister for Chancellor Merkel's coalition government. She's in a coalition government with the Christian Social Union in Bavaria, her party, of course, the Christian Democratic Union, and the Social Democratic Union. Heiko Maas, the Social Democratic foreign minister, announced he went into politics because of Auschwitz. At the same time, he's worked overtime to bust American sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran, the top state sponsor of Holocaust denial, lethal anti-Semitism, and terrorism. The U.S. State Department, as folks know, has prescribed Iran as the top international state sponsor of terrorism. So Heiko Maas has worked to dismantle U.S. sanctions by seeking alternative payment methods so that Germany and Europe can continue to trade with Iran. He went as far this summer to announce that he wants to create an alternative to SWIFT. This is a Belgium-based global messaging bank service that allows cross-border payments. It's crucial for Iran's economy. The SWIFT system played a huge role in bringing Iran to the negotiating table during the Obama era, once SWIFT disconnected all Iranian financial institutions from its system. The Americans have started to exert pressure on SWIFT to disconnect certain Iranian banks, for example, the Central Bank of Iran. I mentioned this financial background because the finances play a role in funding Iran's anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial and eliminatory anti-Semitism. Now, that's the background in terms of what sort of unfolded over the last few months. And then I should also mention that President Rivlin in Israel's president, appealed to Merkel when she was in Jerusalem in January to join U.S. sanctions. She rebuffed him. So Merkel has a rare, very ugly romance with the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is, I'm quoting the title of an article I wrote in Tablet a few months ago, and I go deeper into the weeds on this longstanding relationship between Iran and Germany. The one form of anti-Semitism that I think is highly neglected both in the U.S. and in Europe in terms of trying to understand what animates Europe to assault and attack Israel on so many different fronts is guilt defensiveness, anti-Semitism. I was struck recently, this Sunday in the New York Post, I read an article, How to Fight Hate. Drastic measures are needed to combat the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe and the U.S. It was authored by Raymond Kelly, the former New York City police commissioner, very distinguished police official with Mitchell D. Silber and David Cohen, also from the New York City Police Department. These are all intelligence officials, and of course the former head of police from the New York City Police Department, which is widely considered, you know, the most effective counterterrorism agency in the world. Kelly and his colleagues did a tour of Europe, and they outlined the traditional forms of anti-Semitism that we're all dealing with right now. I say traditional because they've been so ingrained. The extreme left-wing, progressive anti-Zionism as a practical level, he writes often, or they write often, bleeds into anti-Semitism. Far-right, white nationalism, neo-Nazism, as we saw horrifically in Pittsburgh, and anti-Semitism coming from Muslim populations. Now that's a sort of, you know, he's sort of, you know, scratched the surface on what that means, but what he's neglected to point out, or they again, is what I call anti-Semitism in response to the Holocaust. And this is not my idea, but the idea of two German Jewish Marxist philosophers / sociologists, Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer, who in the 40s began to sort of unravel how Germans were responding to the Shoah. And they used this sort of very fancy sociological term, guilt defensiveness, anti-Semitism. Others have called it secondary anti-Semitism. But the point is, it's how Germans are responding to the Holocaust and their absorption of the guilt associated with the crimes of National Socialism and their parents or grandparents, or in this age, their great-grandparents, and how they respond to this sort of pathological guilt associated with the National Socialist crimes against European Jewry. And in order to purge this pathological guilt, one explanation is Germans turn to Israel as a form of criticism, because it's still largely politically and socially incorrect to criticize Jews, but if you can do indirectly what you can't do directly, namely criticize Israel, as a famous French historian said, the Jew among the nations, you insulate yourself from criticism in Europe of or charges of being an anti-Semite. And Israel has taken on this role in terms of Germans, and I would now argue other countries, mainly all these countries are in Western Europe, to combat the pathological guilt associated with the Holocaust by engaging in this ruthless criticism of Israel, and to help alleviate or ameliorate the guilt by, as many of us know, making these comparisons of Israelis are, or the Israeli army or the Israeli government is comparable to the Hitler movement, apartheid in South Africa, the whole running narrative that's front and center right now in the media and criticism of Israel. The Nazi comparison, of course, has been to some extent shifted to the margins as being extreme, but certainly apartheid and some of these other highly odious terms are still there. My view now is that this guilt defensiveness, anti-Semitism, has now fully bled or been absorbed into hatred of Israel or modern anti-Semitism, and it's become to the point where, to use some sarcasm from an Israeli psychoanalyst, the Western Europeans will never forgive the Israelis for the Holocaust. Zvi Rex, as many of you probably know, is an Israeli psychoanalyst who famously said in the late mid to late 1980s, excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold, the Germans will never forgive the Jews for Auschwitz. He meant that sarcastically, but that one sentence profoundly captures the type of anti-Semitism that was taking place in Germany, again, in response to the Shoah, and in Austria, I would argue. The problem now is, and it's a ubiquitous problem, it's not just limited to Germany and Austria, is you see countries like France and Norway and other countries that were complicit in the crimes of the National Socialists. You see, and again, I'm engaging in sweeping generalizations, so put scary quotes on this because we only have 25 minutes, and I can't get into the concrete information, where you see large swaths of the population believing that or engaging in this type of modern anti-Semitic conduct and also thinking because of the guilt associated with the Holocaust, and that's in France and, as I've mentioned, other Western European countries. In Germany, one study, I think, can shed some light on how widespread the problem is. The Bundestag last year, 2017, published a report. I'm sorry, it was published by a commission that was commissioned by the Bundestag, Germany's federal parliament, to examine anti-Semitism. These reports are churned out every few years, and you know, they create a bit of a media sensation, and then they're back on the library shelves or somewhere in the Bundestag, and no one pays attention to them. But one statistic showed that 40% of Germans hold a modern anti-Semitic view, that is their loathing of Israel. I suspect the number is significantly higher because the questions are still very sort of nebulous, but they do get at this view of, you know, comparing Israel with odious regimes and blaming Israelis in connection with, or Jews in connection with the Holocaust, and trying to get at this pathological guilt. Back to the article by Raymond Kelly in the New York Post, this type of anti-Semitism was not analyzed or even acknowledged. And that has a lot to do, again, because Americans aren't exposed to these attitudes from Western Europeans on a daily basis. And for those who've lived in Western European countries, I would imagine they've encountered this when they've talked to their counterparts about, talked to normal, ordinary people about Israel and experienced this intense preoccupation and expressions of hatred targeting Israel. Even in Europe, I would argue, this type of anti-Semitism is routinely ignored, played down, and it's highly dangerous because it plays into alliances with Islamic-animated anti-Semitism or Muslim-animated anti-Semitism and other groups where its ability, and I'm talking about the guilt defensiveness anti-Semitism, to coalesce with other groups and form alliances. And that's why you see, for example, at the Al-Quds demonstration in Berlin, a Iranian-sponsored event started by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran to call for Israel's destruction each year in the heart of Berlin. You see disparate groups who have nothing in common with each other. For example, Palestinian activists, Nazis, Hezbollah supporters, Iranian regime supporters, of course, and left-wing secular political activists in Germany joining the march to attack Israel. And that's where a lot of this guilt defensiveness, anti-Semitism plays out and can form alliances with groups that should not, in theory, be aligned. I think that's a factor that's been ignored. So that's, I think, an important factor in what's playing out right now in Europe. I should mention that on the issue of Iranian relations, Chancellor Merkel has been terribly ineffective, her administration, in combating Iranian-sponsored anti-Semitism in Germany. There are 950 members of Hezbollah a U.S. designated and Canadian and United Arab League, or Arab League, excuse me, designated terrorist organization, fully designated. The Europeans, including Germany, have only prescribed the so-called military win of the terrorist organization after Hezbollah operatives murdered or blew up an Israeli tour bus in Burgas, Bulgaria in 2012, murdering 5 Israelis and injuring 32 Israelis and killing also their Bulgarian Muslim bus driver. The Europeans did not have the backbone to outlaw all of Hezbollah, as the United States and Canada and the Netherlands, I should say, is the one exception, have done over the years. So you have these lethal anti-Semitic terrorist organizations who are raising money and recruiting members in Germany and are part of this anti-Semitic increase of anti-Semitism, but Germany refuses to outlaw the group. It could unilaterally outlaw the group, but Germany hides behind the curtain of the EU and says, unless the EU, the European Union, reaches a consensus, we're not going to do anything. Also, the mainstreaming of the Islamic Republic of Iran is on an accelerated course. The former German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel has visited Iran 3 times since the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran nuclear deal, was reached in 2015. He was just there last week meeting with a Holocaust denier, Ali Larijani, the head of the parliament, and Gabriel has gone there to boost business deals and brought large business delegations. Gabriel is the former foreign minister until earlier this year, a social democrat. He's as the son described, a left-wing hothead and the son of a Nazi. But he's claimed he's rejected his father's Nazism. But there is certainly a strange, this is sort of a strange way of rejecting your father's Nazism when you continue to meet with, a motley crew of Holocaust deniers and Iranian anti-Semites who are bent on obliterating Israel. Gabriel was also praised by Hamas earlier this year after I reported in the Jerusalem Post that he again called Israel an apartheid regime when meeting with Muslims, German Muslims and immigrants and refugees and migrants, I believe largely from Syria and Berlin. He told them after there was instances of flag burning, which you may have read about during during the period when the U.S. decided to relocate its embassy to Jerusalem, that there are other ways to express yourselves about dealing with Israel. He mentioned his comment earlier from a number of years ago when he was in the West Bank that he called Israel an apartheid regime. After I published my report, Hamas on Twitter praised him, only, I think, 4 or 5 months later, he then said he would not use that phrase again and realized that maybe he had gone too far. After students also had protested his talk at a German university, which I thought was interesting, and passed out flyers about Sigmar Gabriel promoting anti-Semitism or aiding anti-Semites. So that gives one sense of what's happening on the political level. I should also mention over the years, Iranians have, officials have denied the Holocaust and called for Israel's destruction. In Germany in 2008, Mohammed Larijani, the head of the sort of phony Human Rights Commission in Germany, called for Israel's destruction and denied the Holocaust at a foreign ministry-sponsored event. There was scarce criticism of him. A year later, his brother, Ali Larijani, the head of Iran's, again, phony parliament, denied the Holocaust at the Munich Security Conference. Germany's prosecutors did not even attempt to investigate. Even if there was a case of diplomatic immunity at work, you would expect mass widespread outrage among politicians. The Holocaust now from these high-level Iranian officials was met with silence, largely silence. At the same time, when Bishop Williamson, Richard Williamson, as folks probably remember, denied the Holocaust, Merkel turned to the Pope and urged the Pope at the time to clamp down on Williamson's Holocaust in Germany prosecuted Williamson. So the question is, why is there a disconnect? Why is Germany aggressively and, you know, enforcing its law against Bishop Richard Williamson, who denied the Holocaust, but not expressing outrage about the Iranian Holocaust? Even at a minimum, Merkel could urge the Khamenei, Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, to call on him to stop denying the Holocaust in a public statement, but she won't at least go that far in terms of Iran. In terms of Iranian trade, I just should mention that the small Jewish community in Germany registered number is about, from the Central Council of Jews in Germany, a little less than 100,000. It hovers around 100,000 registered Jews in Germany. The numbers may be as high as 200,000. No one really knows the exact, the precise number above what the registered number of 100,000. The head of the community, Joseph Schuster, did call on Merkel, or in general terms, and German civil society, to stop trade with Iran. Germany exported $3.42 billion in trade to Iran in 2017. Schuster, the head of the Jewish community, Joseph Schuster, called for an end of trade, and he alluded in pretty crystal clear terms that there are question marks whether Germany has internalized the lessons of the Holocaust, because Germany continues to be wedded to the Iranian regime on so many levels and won't break relations. And take the example of Canada. Canada does not have a special relationship with Islam, with Israel, but Canada has slashed diplomatic relations with Iran and led the effort in many ways to sanction Iran's regime, and holds parliamentary meetings about human rights violations in Iran. All of this is non-existent in Germany, which rhetorically has a so-called special relationship with the Jewish state. Going over to BDS now, there have been some important developments. Many of you have, I'm sure, followed the Women's March developments, including the founder yesterday announcing that she wants new leadership because the Women's March leadership is contaminated with homophobia and anti-Semitism and bigotry. Last week, I reported, it was the first report in the English language press, it was in fact the first report outside of Germany, about the Friedrich Ebert Foundation. That's the Social Democratic Party's think tank or foundation. After a group of PhD-affiliated students with the think tank, they get scholarships from the Friedrich Ebert Foundation. Some of them, I believe, that may have already graduated or completed their dissertations, wrote the foundation's head and said, we don't think you should give your human rights award to the Women's March because of, and they outlined Linda Sarsour's anti-Semitism, the statements, all the sort of running shopping list of anti-Semitic statements and actions coming from many of the leaders of the Women's March. The leadership of the Friedrich Ebert Foundation rescinded its award and said it would investigate the allegations before it awards the prize to the Women's March. This group of PhD students, and I don't know who they are except their name, it's a group of students who study, as I understand, Jewish civilization in Israel. It appears to be some type of caucus group or the students who are actually involved in the academic study of Israel and anti-Semitism, obviously understood what was happening. A lot of the reader comments to my article at the Jerusalem Post were, how could a leading think tank not be aware of this? That's the point of a think tank, to jump into the future, analyze these issues, and understand what what's happened. I think a lot of that criticism is justified because, Google, a simple search engine search, would show a lot of the unsavory things that are happening among the leaders of the Women's March. Now, the leaders of the Friedrich Ebert Foundation may have known that, and they thought, well, you know, we're willing to tolerate high levels of anti-Semitism to advance the other positive aspects of women's rights, or they may just have been oblivious. We don't really know, but they did rescind the award, and then the notification of this decision did appear in a number of American outlets, namely in the center right of the sort of blogosphere and the American media. And the Israeli press, I just noticed today, Haaretz finally mentioned that this NGO, the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, rescinded its award. It's a big deal, I should say, because the Ebert Foundation has offices all across the world, including in Washington. They have a very well-financed budget, and they're involved in all sorts of human rights work, and they're the ideas factory for the Social Democratic Party, a party that's part of the governing coalition in Germany. A couple of other positive developments over the years. The university,
to the time, so we have enough time for questions. We're at 12:30 now, so just, pay attention to, so we have some questions as well.
Okay. I will then close here, just outlining a couple of the victories that I think might be of interest. The University of Vienna students voted a couple of years ago to outlaw BDS on their campus and declared it anti-Semitic. Students at Gutenberg in Mainz also declared BDS to be anti-Semitic. Also in Frankfurt and in Leipzig, these different universities, Heidelberg, Germany's oldest university, initially voted 16-15 against BDS, close vote, and then it was reversed because there was some irregularity with the ballots that they didn't, that they were supposed to, it was supposed to be, I believe, a secret ballot, so that was the one setback in Heidelberg. And a number of German intelligence reports, three of the intelligence reports have designated BDS as anti-Semitic. The German intelligence agency, the domestic intelligence agency, is roughly the equivalent of the FBI without police powers. So I'll end there. Thanks for your time, and welcome questions.
Great. Well, thank you, Benny, for that in-depth, real analysis of Europe, which is I think many of our listeners is new in comparison to what we're facing here in North America. So with that being said, I mean, the floor is now open. As I said before, if should you have a question, and of course we welcome. You could also email us questions, or we can also read them for you. Let me start off, Benny. I guess while people think about questions, I'll take the prerogative as the moderator as far as the environment. You've given us a real in-depth understanding of Europe, and you and I have had many conversations about these issues. And you've spoken about the tricky relationships as it relates to Israel. We're looking at the environment here in the States with the rise of a lot of these of anti-Semitism on the right, on the left, on the heels of Pittsburgh. I guess to my mind, what are the lessons learned, or what should we be looking at as far as the environment in North America as it relates to Europe, and what can we hear on the other side of the pond look at and to be cognizant of as we're grappling here as well with how to deal with these threats. And in addition to that, you ended your remarks on the question of what's going on European campuses. One of the challenges, as we're dealing with here in North America, is of course the tension between academic freedom and when does academic freedom, when does anti-Semitism, you know, is it academic freedom? Is it not? When does anti-Zionism bleed into anti-Semitism? So if you could comment about those issues, I think that'll be helpful to our listeners.
Well, I think in terms of Europe and the U.S., I think the main departure point right now should be anti-Semitism has to be viewed in many ways as a counterterrorism project. When folks visit Europe, I'm sure they've seen the fortress-like systems that protect synagogues and Jewish institutions and Israeli institutions and embassies across, mainly Western Europe. That system, and I think this is where I agree with Raymond Kelly in the New York Post, the intensified security. I don't want to get into a blame game, but it's Michael Levine, who's a freedom scholar at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, recently wrote in PJ Media, in a way, one, you know, the lack of attacks on this level, in terms of what took place in Pittsburgh, are sort of unsurprising, because we know that there's been a high level of anti-Semitic attacks over the years, not just starting with the Trump administration. It's been continuous that American Jews have always been on the high end of attacks based on national data. So I think that's a key, at least in the states, that where the states in some way may have to replicate some of the things that are happening in, like, France, for example, Germany, where there's intensified security. Where Jews are also more self-organized, for example, the Britain Community Security Trust, it's a Jewish institution where volunteers provide protection to their own institutions. I think self-organization among American Jews to protect their institutions are important. Obviously, the Second Amendment is in place in the U.S. in comparison to Europe, so there's also that option. Which is, can't be denied given what happened in Pittsburgh. It's a factor. In terms of the college campuses, Asif, can you just repeat that part of your question?
Yeah, as it relates to, the debate in the United States, as you're seeing around the country, even with the rise of what I would consider to be, and I think many of us see as blatantly anti-Semitic, is that there's still a healthy tension between when does anti-Zionism bleed into anti-Semitism? To argue basically that anti-Zionism is purely legitimate criticism and anti-Semitism is racism. And to that end, it all falls under this umbrella of academic freedom, and because in the United States, colleges see academic freedom as religion, and if it is indeed to their minds, anti-Zionism is legitimate, then it falls as part of their academic freedom to express those viewpoints. Similar case in point that we saw now with the University of Michigan, where the professor who refused to write a letter of recommendation to a student going to study in Israel, he saw that as part of his academic freedom because he's a member of the BDS group. I mean, things of those sorts play out here. I'm wondering, as it relates to Europe, where academic freedom, at times is very different, what can you tell us about, the environment there as it relates to these issues?
Well, the free speech argument is still, playing out on universities. For example, in Germany, there was a talk last week with a left-wing author who supports BDS from a German public newspaper called TAZ. And there was Jewish students in Bavaria and in Munich, because he spoke at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, protested and called for the talk to be canceled. The university said, no, this is part of, this is protected free speech, etc. But there have been other instances I know of where unions and universities have canceled speeches because because the BDS rhetoric or the anti-Israeli rhetoric constitutes anti-Semitism. So it's there's no uniformity. I should mention, even here in the States, when I read this article in the New York Post by Raymond Kelly and his former colleagues from New York City Police Department, they didn't even consider anti-Zionism to be anti-Semitism. They wrote extreme left-wing progressive anti-Zionism that, as a practical left, will often bleed into anti-Semitism. I think, and I've been saying this for years, and this is nothing new. I mean, this has been said for over 51 years, or going back to the 60s with Jean Henri, who said, equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. I don't think you can make the separation now. One could have, as the late Professor Wistrich from Hebrew University said, arguably the world's leading scholar of anti-Semitism, that before World War II, one could have made that argument that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, but given the existence of the Jewish state, anti-Zionism is simply calling for an eradication of Israel, and that's a form of eliminatory anti-Semitism. So I found that to be a bogus argument, and I think when I read that in so many American publications, and also in Europe, but less in Germany, I'm surprised at times, I think that needs to be confronted and negated.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that these are all the things that we are challenged here, as well. I mean, I think that this ongoing tension. I mean, I agree. With Wisbech, I agree with you on on trying to make those attempts. I mean, but obviously they are the supporters of BDS clearly are trying to make those arguments so it is sold as legitimate. Especially on North American college campuses. Again, I'll say to our listeners, again, if you have questions, please feel free to ask, hit the icon of the hand and I will gladly unmute you so you can ask Benny any questions you may have. If not, obviously, Benny and I can, we will continue our powwow here. As far as trying to dissect some of these matters, which I think are there's a lot to talk about. Benny, the part of the thing that you've been reporting a great deal on, and I think you've mentioned it obviously in your comments this morning to us. You're seeing blatant involvement of Hezbollah and Hamas, within European circles. Infiltrating, as far as the discourse, as far as the environment, as it relates to European politics. Now, post the midterm elections here, we are dealing with a lot of what I would consider to be the normalizing of anti-Semitism in the American political discourse. You're seeing, I'm sure. Many of our listeners have seen, individuals like Rashida Tlaib and other individuals who've been elected to office now who are blatant supporters of BDS and how that will affect their decision-making processes, their constituencies. We're seeing a lot of that already happening in Europe. What are you seeing in that regard? What can we look toward? What can we look at? What can we be critical of? What should we be doing? We're dealing with this new environment, so to speak.
Well, with the election of pro-BDS, congressional representatives from, as I understand it, Minnesota and Michigan, the Americans now, and those fighting BDS, have a serious problem on their hands, because one could imagine, and I just heard this recently when I was on Capitol Hill delivering some talks, that there may even be pro-BDS legislation proposed. I can't imagine it would be enacted, but it's a start, and we know how this type of anti-Semitic activity rapidly spreads. It moves at an astonishingly fast pace since I first started writing about and analyzing BDS back in 2006, a year after the BDS movement formally declared its goals in 2005. So we've seen how they've moved their agenda and advanced their agenda at an astonishingly fast pace since 2005. So I would be extremely unsettled by what's happening in Congress and on the political level. On the other hand, you have now 26 states that have passed anti-BDS legislation, but there's an appeal taking place, I believe, in Arizona. So we don't know how that's going to play out, whether the Arizona state government will prevail against an ACLU suit. So there's a lot of counter resistance and BDS is becoming mainstream within Congress because of the president's mainstream in the sense that among some politicians in Congress, which is I think a major setback for the counter BDS campaign. In the end, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here for the folks on the phone. In the final analysis, what it's going to take to prevail is the legislation is important, but it's really going to be a grassroots campaign against a grassroots campaign. And the pro-BDS activists and the anti-Semitic forces within this campaign on the BDS, the pro-BDS side, I think at this point have out-organized the anti-BDS campaign and forces. And that's largely because the anti-BDS campaign got a very late start, but they are making progress. But it has to be more grassroots organizing. There's more of that on some level. There are slivers of that I've seen on German universities where student groups, pro-Israel German student groups, have mobilized and taken the lead to pass anti-BDS resolutions. So that there's a lot to learn, I think, from some of these groups in Vienna, student groups, Leipzig, Frankfurt, and in Mainz.
Sure. Great. Well, I appreciate that. Well, we have two questions. Let me read them to you, and we can tackle them. So first, the question that Sonia has for us, Sonia Bloomfield. She writes that I am from Brazil, and BDS is also involved in universities and unions here as well. And BDS is working hard to blame Jews for the problems of minority groups, African-American groups and others, and especially now that there's a new pro-Israel president who's been elected in Brazil. She's asking, is BDS worldwide also working among other minority groups against Israel? If you could comment on that.
That's an interesting question. I thought it was interesting that the German PhD students at the Friedrich Ebert Foundation pointed out Linda Sassoor's alleged anti-Semitic remark by claiming that Jews were behind, or Israelis, excuse me, behind the racist attack in St. Louis or in Missouri involving police officials. There was if I remember correctly. So the German PhD students picked up on this, that BDS activists were exploiting minority groups to advance their anti-Semitic agenda. In other countries, with minority populations, including in Germany and across Europe, one sees these alliances because in Germany there are 4 to 5 million German Muslims and non-German Muslims form alliances with these groups and, are able to create these types of joint alliances with minority groups that, in the eyes of many other Germans, helps their stature because you have what's perceived as, as an oppressed minority group in Germany, Muslims or refugees or migrants by many Germans, and they're suddenly standing up and working with BDS activists or people of color. But it's not, I don't, my sense is it's not as prevalent as identity politics in the U.S. or this sort of extreme multiculturalism and this hyperbolic identity politics in the U.S. I don't see that as much in Central Europe. Certainly in the United Kingdom, it's a different cat. Around the world, I don't know enough, for example, about Chile, which has, you know, a very large Palestinian diaspora population, or some of these other countries. Certainly the identity politics in the UK, that's become very extreme. I could see that spilling over to the US, and you could see more of, this type of, where BDS activists are seeking minority groups to advance their agenda. All eyes are on the Women's March right now because of the alliance of minority groups and how that's playing out. So I think the big test in many ways will be the U.S. Women's March, to see how this plays out, because that could set a model for Europe and other countries, depending on who prevails and whether, you know, whether they're capable, those opposing anti-Semitism and homophobia, to root out on some extent the ingrained anti-Semitism and homophobia.
Good, thank you. Well, we have two more questions. Let me read them to you. Our next question is from Ralph Goldfinger, and Ralph asks if you can expand a little bit on the transgression from anti-Semitism, which is taboo, to acceptable anti-Zionism. Is there anything more you want? I think you addressed some of that, but I know if maybe you want to say another point or two on that issue as well.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I don't make a distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, as some do. I think contemporary anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism, and anti-Zionism is contemporary anti-Semitism. Thinkers going back to, as I mentioned, the Auschwitz survivor Jean-Henri diagnosed this type of anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, back in, I believe, in 1967. And there have been other thinkers in the 70s and 80s in Germany who have also unraveled this new form of anti-Semitism. One thinker is Henrik Broder, a very prominent German Jewish journalist. So again, there's sort of nothing new under the sun here. It's just the phenomenon has become so ubiquitous that it's you know, staring us in the face. And now I think to enlighten students and civil society, one needs to really point out that the nature of anti-Zionism and what that means, and not fall into this sort of dangerous trap of, well, we can somehow separate this. I find that to be intellectually dishonest. And as you know, as I mentioned, many of these student groups in Europe, including pro-Israel German students and organizations, are, you know, of the view, and they've been of the view for decades now. I've been based in Germany since 2002, that anti-Zionism is identical with anti-Semitism.
No, thank you, and I personally agree with you, and many of us do. I think that one of the major differences, obviously, that we're seeing today, to your point, really nothing new is under the sun, but the repackaging of this old identity, and you know, the rapidness in which a lot of this information, you know, has been disseminated through the use of social media. I mean, that I think is making the environment much more difficult, you know, to combat the issues. It's not, you know, and on the way that it's being transmitted, you know, and used in all facets. I mean, that you know, but ideologically, of course, there is nothing new here in the ideology, but the repackaging of this and the rapidness is indeed something that we obviously are all of us facing. You know, all you have to do is look online every day to find these issues show up. Yesterday, of course, now we're having the issue with the question of Airbnb as it relates to their stance on properties in Israel and the making of distinction properties within you know, the West Bank, not West Bank. I mean, these are all issues that we see on a daily basis. We have another question. You know, I just want to keep us moving as far as time is short and try to stay to our time frame. Abraham Goldstein has a question going back to our question about Brazil. And he's, you know, asking you, Benny, what should we do better to limit the minimum potential impact of BDS? You know, what are things that we can kind of do to kind of curb and squash some of the, you know, the you know, how this is being disseminated?
Well, in terms of you mentioned Brazil, correct?
Yes. You know, he was coming.
Yeah. I think, I mean, obviously if Brazil's new government relocates its embassy to Jerusalem, that's a good thing because that, again, helps to delegitimize BDS and takes the sting out of the legitimacy issue, or the authenticity issue of Israel as a state. And I think on some level, that's the biggest challenge is to combat the delegitimization of Israel and the efforts to strip Israel of its existence and its identity and its authenticity as a nation state. And I think that that's a tall order, and it's going to be an uphill battle, given, you know, how well organized the anti-Israel movement is right now. But it can be done. And the, you know, Chancellor Merkel, who, you know, is working against Israel and claims to be, you know, a great friend of the Jewish state, is contributing to BDS, as we've seen with her decision to lobby Romania's president. And I believe, based on my reporting, she, according to one source, believes she lobbied other European governments not to relocate their embassies. The relocation of embassies to Jerusalem will help, as I said, undercut the BDS movement. In terms of the question, what can be done to counter it, Asaf? I think one is to recognize, in contrast to some, I just read an op-ed yesterday in the Ford last night, arguing that, you know, BDS is not anti-Semitic. The op-ed dealt with the Women's March, and this journalist who works for the Ford is of the view that BDS is not anti-Semitic. It's a nonviolent movement. Tonight, I'm going to give a talk at ISGAP, Charles Small's Center on anti-Semitism, and in Manhattan. I'm going to show videos of where BDS activists in Germany have disrupted a film presentation devoted to the Holocaust, and also a speech with a member of Yesh Atid and a Holocaust survivor at the Humboldt University last year. These were BDS activists from England and in other countries who disrupted these events. The videos are online. So you get a sense that, you know, is this really peaceful? And then the other demonstrations that we've seen where BDS activists show up, they're working with the PFLP. I should just mention, this is a whole other topic, but a lot of my work has gone into showing the connections between BDS groups and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That's a U.S. and EU-prescribed terrorist organization. So you have PayPal and other European banks have shut down the bank accounts of these BDS organizations because over the last few years, I've done exposés on the interplay between terrorist entities and BDS organizations and what that means for illicit terror finance. So I think to combat BDS, one needs to show, A, that there's also a counterterrorism component to the campaign, or to combat BDS, an illicit terror finance aspect. And I would argue it's, and I can't stress this enough, one needs to make the case, and I think it's crystal clear at this point, that BDS is inherently an anti-Semitic organization. But does that mean activists all the activists involved in BDS and supporters are infected with modern anti-Semitism? No, of course not. But the goals of BDS are inherently anti-Semitic. So one needs to turn BDS into a pariah organization, because it is, when you know, it is, it should be a pariah organization based on its goals, namely, you know, we can get into all the factors, the return of all Palestinian refugees, or what that means for the state of Israel, it would mean the obliteration. I mean, many folks on this call, I'm aware, are very well versed in these topics. Just a matter of articulating these ideas. But I do think the counterterrorism point is neglected, and we've seen a lot of cases in Europe where BDS organizations are openly supporting the PFLP or engaging in violating anti-discrimination laws, like in France, that has a very robust anti-discrimination law that bars discrimination based on national origin, and the French authorities have, to their credit, enforced the law and closed bank accounts or prosecuted French citizens because of discrimination based on national origin. That is targeting Israelis.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for all of that. I mean, I think, you know, you're right. I mean, on the issue of the financing, which you've been on the forefront, I mean, that's exactly one of the issues that is not happening here in the States as far as shutting down bank accounts related to funds. I mean, I think that obviously something to look into as we're looking forward to crack down on and to try to suffocate some of where all these monies are coming from, what they're actually financing with these monies, which has been a extremely useful tactic in Europe. Our time is short, unfortunately, and I first of all, I want to, you know, thank you, Benny, for this extremely important, in-depth understanding of Europe. Obviously, we have a lot of layers to dissect. There's a lot going on, and of course, part of why SPME was created to deal and to help our members and many of us who are on campuses dealing with these issues head on. But obviously, there are the outside feeders that we're talking about, you know, politically from unions and other groups that are impacting the environment on campus. So this is something we will continue dissecting. I want to thank everybody this afternoon for joining us. I want, you know, obviously we will continue with this call, with these monthly calls next month. I want to take the opportunity, of course, to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. I want to thank you, Benny, for taking the time to be with us this afternoon. Again, if there are questions afterwards, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. Again, our email address is bdsmonitor@spme.org, bdsmonitor@spme.org, and we will look forward to continuing the conversation next month. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Benny, and we will talk soon.
Thank you.